This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas, presented by U Mobile.
This is the Breakfast Grill. I'm Tan Chung Han, and today we welcome Dr. Andy Shi, independent economist and director of Rosetta Stone Advisors. Good morning, Dr. Shi, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Doctor, you have been named among the 50 most influential persons in finance by Bloomberg back in 2013. And you're one of the few economists who has accurately predicted economic bubbles, including the 97-98 financial crisis in Asia, also the subprime meltdown in the U.S. about a decade ago. So, Doctor, I want to kick things off with a bang here. How close are we to the next global financial crisis?
I think we are very close to another one, and possibly next year. The reason is because that after 2008, the world did not change its growth model. Instead, it just continued with this debt-led expansion. And the debt this time was a bit different from 2008 cycle when the financial institutions piled up a lot of financial leverage. Since we have seen a lot of leverage piling up in, for example, corporates, now the offshore dollar debt is $12 trillion U.S. dollars, which is about $3 trillion is from Chinese corporates. And mostly property developers. And because they do not earn foreign, they do not have foreign earnings, and their value is, it depends very much on land price in China. So as the land market is cooling down, so this could be a trigger. And we also have other triggers, like in the United States, where all these so-called unicorns, these startup economy, all those companies are now worth like over $1 trillion. You know, they've been borrowing money to expand, even though they all have negative cash flow. So if the market tightens and they could not roll over their debt, there's another trigger. Most of the debt has piled up on the government's balance sheet. So that is kind of makes the financial crisis maybe a little bit different, because there are the people still believe in the government. So this, like the U.S. government debt has doubled since 2008 to $20 trillion. And there are a lot of people still willing to hold the debt. And the central banks could come out to buy the government debts again. It's a bit different from the previously. It was very much market-driven. This time, the governments really are behind the debt. So maybe what we would have is much more like Japan on a global scale. You have a few pockets of debt blow-ups. Then you have the government debt dragging down global economic growth for many, many years to come.
Right. Now, Doctor, speaking about government debt, though, from what we understand, granted the absolute number is increasing, but given the economic growth outlook, while it's slowing down, the global economy is still chugging along. That implies that the government's ability to repay their respective debts, that remains intact. Are you saying that that narrative is flawed?
Oh, yeah, it is, because the debt has been growing faster than the economy. So debt to GDP ratio has been rising. So you look at the U.S. now, it's government debt is 100% of GDP. That's just federal government. And we have a state government that is already $5 trillion. That's 25% of GDP. All historical highs. The last time we saw that was after the Second World War, when the U.S. government piled up debt for fighting the war, and the debt surpassed 100% of GDP. Mm. But I know it's been like the U.S. government debt was very low, only like 15 years ago. It was people were worried about the U.S. government debt disappearing, the bonds were disappearing. So now it's 100% of GDP. It's a total turnaround. And you look at the European governments, the debts are oh, quite close to 100%. It's in, 80 to 90% are quite normal. And you look at the countries like Italy. Most countries in Europe are not competitive, so their economic growth is prospect is not good.
Right.
And still, their debts are at about close to 100% of GDP. So I think that the we are headed towards a worldwide crisis in government debt. Now, the issue is that the governments don't go bankrupt. They can ask central banks to buy their debts. So that will cause inflation. So the world could be heading towards a prolonged period of low growth and inflation. Of inflation, say 3 to 4, or even a bit higher. So it's a form of stagflation.
So what would be the possible triggers then that could prick this debt bubble, so to speak?
Last time it was in 2008 was this zero down payment mortgage and all traded in the market. And this zero down payment, they had this trigger after 2 to 3 years. You don't pay principal or interest, but after 2 to 3 years, you have to increase, you have to pay. That was a trigger in 10 years ago because people didn't have the ability to pay. So when the trigger was switched on, that was the start of the crisis. So it was easier to predict the timing last time because of this special market instrument. But this time, what we see is that, for example, corporate U.S. dollar debt, offshore corporate U.S. dollar debt, there are a lot of the rollovers that need to be need to happen next year. If the market is unwilling to roll over these corporate debts, then it depends on who is holding these high yield bonds. Now, a lot of bonds are held by like private banking kinds. Like in Asia, you have like private banks are very big. You know, they're balanced maybe $3 trillion. It's mostly in high yield debt, I assume. So could it be like just the wealth evaporating for rich people? So maybe we do not feel as much pain as the last time. But there could be a considerable chunk on the bank's balance sheet. So if the banks actually are holding some, and then they could have a capital problem. And as part of the U.S. dollar offshore debt is in the form of syndicated loans. That's where I see that one thing that could trigger this is China's land market. If China's land market does not turn around, it keeps declining like it has been happening this year, then there's no reason for the market to continue to support these borrowers.
Right.
So this is where I see the trigger.
Now, we have noted the deleveraging campaign that the Chinese government has undertaken. At the same time, they are willing to accept a slower growth, right? Do you think that is an acceptable trade-off? And realistically speaking, can governments at this point in time afford to rein in their national debt in absolute terms, in nominal terms?
Well, I think that there's this false narrative that growth is absolutely needed to solve our problems. Hmm. So the narrative, this is a story over the last 20 years. The central banks and a lot of the think tanks have been proposing that we have a lot of problems, but we cannot stop and trying to solve these problems. If we have to push for growth, then these problems just will go away. Turns out to be the wrong narrative. You look at the problems have become bigger and bigger. We have more government debt, more corporate debt. We have more inequality. So it appears the problems becoming bigger and bigger. So this is, I think that we need to change the model. Is that it is a good strategy? Slow down and try to solve our problems.
So, and by solving the problems, you're talking about structural reforms,
yes,
focusing on the people. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think that the inequality over the last 20 years is rising. Inequality is really due to the stimulus-based growth. When there's underlying force driving inequality, when you stimulate the economy, and then you actually increase inequality. That's what's been happening in the West. Despite all these stimulus, the median wage in the United States has been stagnant for 40 years. So this is where I see that we need to go back to look at the inequality issue and understand that the macroeconomic growth actually depends on reasonable income distribution. If we have too skewed distribution, then there's no consumption base because people don't have money to spend. Some people have too much money. Some people don't have money to spend. Then the central banks think the solution is for the rich people to lend money to the poor people to spend. And that keeps the corporate profits going. So one guy's profit is another guy's debt. That is very dangerous. Because how could the poor people ever be able to repay their debts?
Doctor, this is a fascinating conversation. We got to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll further dive into the risk of the next global financial crisis. I'm speaking to Dr. Andy Shi, independent economist. We'll be right back right here on The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Thanks for staying with us here on The Breakfast Grill. I'm Tan Chung Han, and with me is Dr. Andy Shi, independent economist, and he was named one of the 50 most influential persons in finance back in 2013 by Bloomberg. Now, Dr. Shi, in a recent article that you posted on the South China Morning Post, it's titled, "Why the Trade War Will Usher in a Long, Drawn-Out Bear Market." Now, earlier you spoke about the risks to the next global financial crisis, leverage, debt. That is a big, big problem. Now, how does the trade war then complicate that equation?
The growth model in the past is based on low inflation, because of the global competition, you keep wage low. Then the people don't have a consumption power. You lend them money, so they borrow money and to buy stuff. Then the companies cut costs by moving production to low cost countries, and their demand is supported by debt. So the corporate balance sheet looks like they have a lot of high margin, like Apple iPhone is like a margin is 50%. And now, if these kind of margin is meaningless, if you have to lend money to your consumers, to the buyers, so that story ended carnivally in 2008. Since 2008, we have been government borrowing money to give the money to the people to buy. We have this bull market based on looking at a corporate profit, but the corporate profit is somebody else's debt, and this dynamic works because of low inflation. And low inflation is because 800 million people in China work for very little for multinational companies. So the trade war means that the American workers have been suffering from stagnant wages, and there's a political backlash. So there's this political response. So when you have this trade war like that, the disinflation story we have seen over the last 25 years is coming to an end. So inflation will be ticking up over the next few years. That means that the central banks cannot increase money supplies like before anymore. That's all. That means you have to reverse the story of like one guy's debt, one guy's profit is somebody else's debt, and that dynamic is not sustainable. So until the world has reached a new equilibrium, what we're seeing is this unwinding. So you will see corporate profit margin will decline over the next few years. This is the beginning of a structural bear market.
So given that what you said there, that structural bear market, how should markets position themselves then? Should they take a fatalist approach and just brace for this hard reset which is necessary? Or are there positions that can perhaps mitigate the effects of this, like you said, long drawn out bear market?
Well, you should have to avoid the market darlings over the last few years. It's all based on very high growth technology hype, like these internet companies. Eventually, most of these companies will become worthless, just like in the previous tech bubbles. So I think for investors, they need to look at the big companies that have been ignored by the market, like energy, like telecom, like automobile. Oh, those are the sectors that they still look a reasonable valuation. But anything that is a little bit like appealing, people are talking about it, it's become very expensive. You look at even like a beer company, an industry that is not growing, could be trading at 20 times or higher. You know, some yogurt companies trading at like 30 times. So globally, assets are huge overvalued because of this excess liquidity released by the central banks. But only the industry people are scared of, like people think automobile industry will disappear because of all these tech guys who they say they're inventing stuff. They've been talking about this for 10 years. Still, nothing is happening. Look, I think this gigantic bubble. Now, autonomous driving vehicle is not coming. So they can't have it down. So the other is on energy side. Energy side is like it's very difficult to move away from fossil fuel. I'm not a fan of fossil fuel, but for investors, we cannot move it away from the next 20 or 30, even 30 years. So, but these stocks are trading at a low valuation because they think that the tech market thinks that the tech revolution is going to make them obsolete. So right. That's why some of the stocks are still reasonably cheap.
If I may push back a little bit, I mean, from what I gather from your position, it seems to employ a more traditional perspective on how the economy should work, right? As opposed to the tremendous potential that the tech sector has. Now, you question the gains or the kind of tangible economic activity that the tech sector has actually generated. But then when you look at what Amazon is doing and what Facebook, Google around the world, it seems to have this multiplier effect. So are we at risk of perhaps not seeing the true potential of the tech sector?
No, I don't think so. I think that a lot of tech companies, they are offering consumer products. They are not really revolutionizing the production process. Mm. So there's a limit. There are limits to how much you can penetrate the consumer market. Like a mobile phone market, for example, is shrinking. So why these tech-based consumer products not like any other product? The other story is this tech wave has a very limited impact on productivity. Mm. That's why the global economic growth has not accelerated. So it's like everywhere you see mobile phones everywhere, except in economic statistics, you know, we don't see it's driving economic growth. Instead, it may be hampering economic growth because people are wasting their time on mobile phones.
Is the boom in the tech sector over the last few years, are there any similarities with the 2000.com bubble, which you predicted?
Oh, well, similar in some ways is that there's overvaluation. But the difference is that in this way, some companies do make money, like Google and Facebook. But we have to remember their revenue is based on advertising. Now, why they have a high margin is because, like Facebook, instead of a traditional media company, they don't actually produce content. They just get people to entertain each other. Then they advertise. So it's kind of a very low-cost model. So that's why it seems to have very high profit margin. Okay, but still, advertising market is limited in size. Any economy, advertising budget as a share of GDP is limited. So once these companies have destroyed all the traditional media companies, they have taken all the advertising revenue, where is the growth after? So we should not extrapolate the growth from now into indefinite future, because they right now they are in the penetration phase. Once the market is saturated, like what we're seeing in the mobile phone business, then everything is going to slow down.
So what's your message then? We have to place more emphasis on the traditional drivers of growth. Is that what you're saying here?
I think that the most important thing for the world is energy, okay? The gadgets are not important.
Hmm.
And people like the gadgets catch our attention because we use gadgets all the time. But if the gadgets disappear tomorrow, the economy doesn't change. That is not affected by that much. So this is where I think people are mistaken, because information is such a powerful in terms of perception, is so powerful because it reaches you every day, every minute. You think this is a very big deal.
Mm.
But it's just a perception.
Doctor, with the little time that we have left, I want to come back to China then, because this conversation comes just a couple of days before that highly anticipated G20 summit over there in Buenos Aires. And of course, one of the highlights is the meeting between US President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping. Now, a few months ago, in your assessment of the trade war, you said that there's a lot of shadow boxing going on. But in recent months, we have seen tariffs actually being implemented onto
yes.
both U.S. and Chinese goods, and we've potentially got another round of tariffs being implemented come January 1st. So are we still in shadow boxing mode, or has the trade war become real?
I think the trade war has become real. I was wrong thinking that China would act quickly. China thought that it was not a paradigm shift. It was a much traditional bargaining situation. So the bargaining on automobile tariff was, I think, a wrong strategy. The U.S. wanted China to reduce tariff to 2.5% from 25%. China offered to cut it to 15%. That kind of a penny-pinching kind of a bargaining thing really delayed these things. Then it became politicized. Now the U.S. society has changed. So I think that it's very difficult to go back. It's very difficult to go back. Now, having said that, I think at the G20, Donald Trump has incentive to compromise now because of the U.S. stock market is very jittery. And one thing that scares Donald Trump is the stock market. If the stock market crashes, he knows that he will not be reelected in 2020. It's like John McCain in 2008. He didn't have a chance because of the stock market crashed. Mm-hmm. So he understands that. So there's the incentive to compromise. On the other side is that he must, because his re-election is still based on the industrial workers in the Midwest. So he has whatever deal that he gets, it has to look good to these guys. I think that there's a chance for de-escalation, but I think the trade war going away is almost impossible. This is a long-term story.
Perhaps the positioning come this weekend and into the future will be more political-based, more so than based on economic fundamentals, correct?
That's correct. Mm. I think that we're in a very difficult situation. American workers, China has many problems in terms of how it manages its economy, and a lot of criticisms are justified. But there is one story that is going to be with us for a long time, is that Chinese people are very productive and gaining productivity over American workers. And there are like five times as many workers in China as in the United States. So this pressure through global competition on the U.S. workers is just going to escalate over the next decade or two decades or even three decades. So I think the political ramifications are tremendous.
Right, certainly. Doctor, final question here. So bring us full circle. Earlier you mentioned that 2019 could bring the risk of a global financial crisis. So sum up your outlook for 2019 here, given the trade war risks that you outlined, the leverage risks that you mentioned as well. Sum it all up for us before we end.
Well, I think the next year is great uncertainty. This year, 2018, is much more like a 2007 or 1997. While next year is more similar to 2008 or 1998. So we need to keep that in mind, is that don't believe in the story of kind of a portfolio diversification. Times like these, you have to look at a macro risk. The stories of 2008 and 1998 is that when it happens, everything is taken down. So you need to understand that what is a real safe haven in this kind of situation. And you invest only when the bubbles deflated. Don't catch a falling knife in 2019.
Well, Dr. Xi, if it happens, I guess we cannot say that we have not been warned. Thank you so much for your time and your insights. That was Dr. Andy Xi, independent economist and director of Rosetta Stone Advisors. I'm Tan Chung Han, and this is The Breakfast Grill right here on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, Frost & Sullivan Malaysia's mobile data service provider of the year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.